hosts of their respective programs. These views and opinions do not necessarily represent those of Valley Free Radio Incorporated, its volunteers, or any other hosts, guests, or programs on this station.
Sundays at 10 a.m., WXOJ's radio show, Occupy the Airwaves, has the latest news from the occupation movement, locally, regionally, nationally, and around the planet. Tune in at 103.3 FM or webcasting at www.valleyfreeradio.org. Blogging at occupytheairwaves.wordpress.com. Listeners can call into the show at 413-585-1033.
You are listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP Northampton, 103.3 FM. I'm Mayor David Narkowitz, and I support Northampton's community radio station.
Hey, here we go. We have Occupy the Airwaves on Valley Free Radio today for you, WXOJLP 103.3 FM. Good morning, and it's quite a warm day for what we've been experiencing lately. My name is Bob Gardner on the board here, and
it's Darlene. Darlene, good morning, Pioneer Valley. It's really nice to be here this morning. And we also have in the studio...
Yeah. Okay, we're going to introduce our two guests and then give them a chance to speak. But we have Jennifer Taub here from Vermont Law School, and she is also a resident of Northampton and has been active in the Women's March, I think. You were there yesterday, right, Jennifer?
That's right.
Did you speak?
I did not. I was happy to be part of the crowd.
Okay. And Jennifer got quite a reputation from last year, leading up into Tax Day, demanding that Donald Trump, our alleged president, release his taxes, which he's still refusing to do for kind of fake claims. But anyways, that sort of took off with amazing resonance and across the nation, not just locally, but it seemed to happen all across the country. And she can tell us more about that. But and we're going to be hearing a whole bunch more about the marches yesterday, in particular the one in Northampton, and maybe beyond. I don't know. Maybe we have some eyewitness stuff about what happened in Boston and Washington. So stay tuned for that.
So we also have in the studio, and let me tell you, this is going to be a show, two powerhouse women here. It's going to be absolutely awesome, and we're not going to have enough time to talk about all the things. But in the show with us today also is attorney Tahira Amatu Wadul, and she's challenging the U.S. Representative Richard Neal for the 1st Congressional District. She is a Democratic candidate and for 2018. She's also a member of the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women and a board member for the Massachusetts Council for American Islamic Relations. And trying to, you know, update myself a little bit on Tahira, what got me interested in Tahira is the claim that she is going to run unapologetically a progressive campaign. And so I am really intrigued to hear from Tahira what this unapologetic progressive campaign is going to mean in light of the tumultuous status of our country these days. But to begin with, let's talk about the past year. Yesterday was the anniversary, right, of the march. So I remember it being described as the Women's March 2.0. Mm-hmm. And thousands of women all across the United States came out, including here in Northampton. And I believe that the both of you were present in Northampton. Can you both describe for me what you think is different from last year's march? What's the change? What's the feel?
Well, thanks for having me. This is Tahira, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to be here and to share the experiences. So the Pioneer Valley Women's March is where I got to hang out yesterday right here in Northampton, and I had the honor of speaking on the issue. The theme of the program was Our Voices, Hear Our Voices, Hear Our Votes. And what do I see right now happening? It sounds so cliche, and I hate to speak in cliches, but I see the transformation from 2016 into 2017 and going into 2018 with very specific points of how women can lead this change. And you can hear it, you could see it yesterday, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Oh, that sounds absolutely awesome. And I know that last year when we had thousands, I mean, I participated in the March in Washington last year, and there was 500,000 people there alone. I remember that there was an immediate reaction of Trump being elected, right? And many feel that perhaps that was emotional, that was anger, that was people being upset at the election results. This year, it seems to me like people are over that and they want to resist, right? There's a need to protest. It seems to me like this is a movement that is going to stay, is here to stay, and is going to accomplish a lot of change. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, women should have always had a seat at the table. And perhaps in the years before this election, it didn't seem as urgent. But at this point, women are also realizing that we should not yield our power to anyone else. And perhaps the election of Donald Trump has helped reaffirm that if he could get there with all of his weaknesses and vulgarity, then we should be there with all of our strength, intelligence, and ability. And that's where I think 2018 is taking us.
And I think what was somewhat...
Well, I just want to pull Jennifer into this, too. You have the same feeling about this year to last year? And
I do. And I think I'm just going to be echoing a lot of what Tahira said and adding a bit, which is absolutely last year's mm-hmm. theme was really about hearing our voices. Mm-hmm. This year is about hearing our vote. And, you know, if you look at the numbers, I think that folks may be emphasizing maybe the wrong things here. Mm-hmm. In other words, although the D.C. March turnout was smaller this year than last year, what I saw in my own hometown and the numbers I've been observing mm-hmm. online is that scattered in large cities and small towns across the country where there were more than 250 marches between yesterday and some happening today, we had larger local crowd sizes. Mm-hmm. And just look at these numbers. The largest march was in Los Angeles. Mayor Eric Garcetti estimated 600,000 people.
Wow.
Organizers say more, but I'm just giving you the official numbers.
Wow, that's right.
I want to add New York City. You know, the photos are just coming in, and it's amazing, but it stretched for more than 20 blocks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, organizers, or actually Mayor de Blasio's office mm-hmm. officially put out the number is more than 120,000 people.
Wow. I saw a number of 200,000. Wow.
I would believe that. Yep. It's very mm-hmm. hard to gauge crowd sizes. Mm-hmm. So typically the official numbers are at the low end.
Right.
I want to add a few more, which is Chicago had between 200,000 and 300,000. And again, organizers said it was the higher
wow.
end. And what I want to emphasize there is apparently last year, the mm-hmm. crowd turnout mm-hmm. In 2017 was 250,000. Organizers are saying it's, upwards of 350. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Northampton, I was amazed. Last year I had been in Boston, and I know Northampton was a smaller march. This year I've never seen a town like this. You know, thousands of people were gathered. And, you know, it's thanks to speakers like Tahira and mm-hmm. And others, but also organizers, Lindsay Sabadosa and Rachel Maori. I want to really give them credit. And another thing to say is, you know, outside of blue states, mm-hmm. You know, there were incredible turnouts, and they're not mm-hmm. really getting the kind of attention they deserve. You have Nashville, Tennessee, with 15,000 mm-hmm. people. You know, I have to say, I'm waiting. You mm-hmm. hear about all these New York Times stories and other mm-hmm. mainstream media stories, you know, still asking folks, mm-hmm. you know, interviewing Trump voters, right? You know, the Women's March movement mm-hmm. is, you know, if you think about last year, that there was, you know, 3 to 4 million, if not more, people just mm-hmm. nationwide. This mm-hmm. is one of the biggest resistance movements in United States history. you know, and the story is just not getting told. I think folks are waking up. I think there's a lot of sexism around that. You know, I think Matthew Iglesias was saying on Twitter, you know, why isn't this getting more media attention? Why aren't people really focusing on this? But here's a great thing, what I found about folks, you know, women, men, and others in this movement. We don't need credit. We're just going to keep showing up. We're going to keep organizing and keep voting. And this blue wave is coming in November.
I believe, you know, what I was going to say previously is that the reason for such a large turnout with the marches is this sense of intersectionality, right? That there's common ground and common struggles that we're all fighting for, and that the fight for women's rights and equity and equal pay is also a fight, right, against poverty, right? And the fight for dealing with environmental racism issues, right, is also the fight against poverty and health-related issues, right? And I think that, you know, that's what we saw. We saw people coming out on the issues, right, not only the Women's March. One of the things I wanted to talk about, though, is what is your take right now on the government shutdown, right? I just find it very interesting that these two things, the Women's March and the resistance movement, happened basically around the same time.
Yeah. In the first instance, I think what we have to do is recognize that there are people who are very vulnerable who will be impacted by the government shutdown. And I don't want to underplay what that impact will be for day-to-day people. We're talking about people receiving government benefits. We're talking about people receiving military benefits. We're talking about people who are depending on their tax refunds to pay bills and sometimes survive. I have a lot of clients who base their whole annual budgets around those tax refunds. And if the government continues to be shut down for the next few weeks, that money could be delayed in coming to those families. And especially in the first congressional district, as I'm sure in all of Western Massachusetts, families are hardworking, working class people who can't afford to really go without a couple of extra $1,000 they may have been planning on. That said, our government has been shut down to many people for quite a long time. And what the government has been doing and advancing for many people has been more harmful than maybe taking a break, putting a pause on what's happening and using this opportunity to do what my campaign intends to do, which is to center people. The unapologetically progressive platform is that we will center the most marginalized people in the Here for Congress campaign.
I just love it. I love it the way you put it right out there and sent it to Hera, that the government is shut down, but the reality of the matter is it has been inaccessible to so many people for so many years. And that's what the Women's March is about, is about making it accessible and fighting for those rights.
Yes.
How do you feel a little bit about the both of you around the government right now in the White House and Congress, which is Republican dominated right now? As a matter of fact, my understanding is if you were to call the White House this morning and call the comment line, you'd get this voicemail that the government is shut down due to the fault of Democrats, right? But how do you feel about Republicans using DACA right now, the immigration issue, as a bargaining chip not to further fund, you know, the government right now?
And the chip bargaining.
And the chip bargaining, yes. Yeah. How do you feel about that?
The chip, I guess.
You know, I guess I'm going to address two things. First, your most recent question, and sort of go back to the president's incompetency and funding his own government. You know, we have more than 700,000 Dreamers. And, you know, the idea that we should pit folks that everybody says, you know, belong here, are doing amazing things for themselves, their families, and the country. The idea that we should pit them against children struggling and families struggling just to make sure their kids are covered is nonsensical. And this is a tactic that the Republicans have used for years. And guess what? We're not falling for it. We recognize that they're trying to pit us against each other. And, you know, the lack of a sense of urgency. I mean, the CHIP funding was cut off months ago. The president unlawfully ended the DACA program, and he's facing that. You know, a federal court shut that down, and we'll have to follow that case in court. But we have these insensitive, in some cases, unlawful acts by the Trump administration, and you know, the Republicans are just, you know, not expressing the same sense of urgency they did to help ordinary Americans like this and to help Dreamers like this. You know, but they, you know, we can all remember how how important it was to put through that tax scam, that tax cut for the most wealthy and the largest corporations, and to kind of pretend to, you know, wrap that up as if it was helping the rest of us. So no one's really fooled by how they're going to position this. I think we're used to those tactics. But I want to go back to the president not being able to fund his own government. I mean, think about this. One of the selling points that some folks who pushed supported the Trump campaign was that he, you know, had run a business or run several businesses. Of course, they had ignored that many of his businesses had run into financial problems and had filed for bankruptcy. I mean, he'd lined his own pockets at the expense of his, you know, suppliers and his other creditors. And this is something he's done. But that aside, for those who think he's good at running a business, to the extent you want to think about, which I don't think I'd use this, but if you want to think of, if you want to think about his executive branch as him being a CEO, right? If we just took that analogy, again, it's not perfect. There are a lot of reasons why the government is completely not the same as a business. But even if you thought it that way, he just lost his funding, right? It's his job to get that government. It's his government funded, and he was unable to do that. So much for, you know, being a great negotiator.
I think also it's a tactic, though, right? My understanding is that historically Republicans have threatened, right, with government shutdown if they didn't get their way. And this was one example of that, is how they wanted to repeal Obamacare, right, and the Affordable Health Care Act, right? And if they didn't get that repealed, they were going to shut the government down. And now that Democrats are making sure that they are going to stand, right, for immigration rights and for other issues like Social Security and health care, all of a sudden it becomes very problematic, right? It's okay if they do it, but it's not okay when the Democrats as well stand firm on those issues. What do you think about that?
We're talking about basic bargaining power, and it's wonderful that the Democrats are using their bargaining power to say, here's sure. what our values are. Okay. That's what the Democratic okay. process is. I also want to point out, I was reading a New York Times piece from yesterday that—
in Haiti. I mean, come on, really?
I'm not really sure that the president knows what he's doing here. He apparently, you know, he's very upset that he wasn't able to use government funds to go down to Mar-a-Lago for a fundraiser, because that's not essential services. And what we're hearing now from his budget director is that he might not be able to go to Davos with his cabinet. And that would be a huge embarrassment to him wow. on an international scale. Also, apparently, and this is odd, you may have seen earlier in his tweets from 2013 when there was going to be a shutdown under the Obama administration, he said, you know, the buck stops with the president.
Yep.
And if you can believe this, in the Times, it said that he was spending the day yesterday watching television clips where he was attacking President Obama for letting the government shut down. So I'm not quite sure what he thinks. I, you know, possibly he understands that he's to blame and he's trying to deflect that blame onto Democrats, but no one's going to believe it. He really messed up here, and it's because he does not want to support, you know, dreamers, and he doesn't want to support children.
Okay, time out. Everyone needs to have their headphones on. We have a comment or question from Kathy Daly. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hey, how's everybody this morning, Darlene?
Hi, Kathy. How are you? It's so nice to hear your voice this morning.
I'm pretty good. I was wondering, I'm turning the attention back to Tamira.
Tahira.
I just want to stress that she's running for the Massachusetts 1st Congressional District, and I want to know who she's replacing, or she hopefully will be replacing, and what does that district entail? What's the geographical area of that district?
Great question.
Thank you. It is a great question, and especially here in Western Massachusetts, I find myself having to make sure that we describe who the district is and who's currently in the people's seat. So currently in the people's seat is Congressman Neal, and he's been there for 29 years. And the 1st Congressional District touches all of Western Massachusetts and part of Worcester County. So we have 87 cities and towns. It's a very interestingly redistrict community. all of Hampden County, all of Berkshire County, part of Franklin County, part of Hampshire County, part of Worcester County, and it's 3,000 square miles. So when the Tahira for Congress campaign launched, we actually started off in Shelburne Falls and moved over to Pittsfield, and then at the end of the day, wrapped up the launch tour in Springfield, just to prove a point that we will be all over the district hearing from all of our neighbors.
Yay. Yay. That was absolutely awesome. And so, you know, I was reading a little bit that you expect to get some pushback, right? That fake news is going to be picking up on this very quickly. Such a strong, powerful, intelligent, educated woman like yourself running up against Richard Neal. And you had asked for us not to feed into some of that and to remain united. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your progressive campaign issues that you'd like to address?
Yes, I love talking about the issues. And just if I could just go back to a little bit to the fake news. What happens, though, when you have women who are achieving strides of power, and when those women are Black, when those women are Muslim, you have three factors that people can hone into to sort of transfer their hatred towards and direct it towards, and particularly being a Muslim woman. Just like you have people who are Holocaust deniers or climate change deniers, you have people who spend lots of money also exerting these scare tactics and fear tactics around Islamophobia. And so that's been happening since I started doing some pretty strong work in 2015. And we've noticed it, but it's almost laughable how transparently ridiculous some of those things are. And I would never, ever expect that it would come from people here in a district or people here who are involved in politics, but it's more on a national level of people who just hate to see women succeed. So my platform issues, and I have this beautiful 2 or 3 page platform for the Tahira for Congress campaign that I haven't published yet because I want to make sure that it's just perfect. But it includes these wonderful goals of making sure that we look at every person, every value that needs to be focused on, and make sure that we're hearing from people and committing to doing that. So right now, what primarily I'm hearing from folks is that they're concerned about economic job security and stability. And here in the first congressional district, the median income is $49,000. That's not a lot of money. We have a higher than average unemployment rate here in the district. We have a significant population that does not have access to high-speed internet. Now, if you stop for a minute, if you live in Springfield, Chicopee, any of the urban areas where you could just pull up high-speed internet, that's not something that you're aware of, but we have people amongst us, in the rural districts particularly, who are using dial-up, like 1996 AOL-type dial-up, to access their internet. And think about the gaps that are happening in those kids and those families and the kids and the families who cannot access this very important tool that I'd say is more than a luxury, and how that impacts economic growth and development as well as education. We have an opioid crisis that is occurring. It's ravaging our communities. 2,000 opioid deaths last year alone. And we're not talking about opioid crisis only from a compassionate and clinical perspective, but we also have to do it from a human rights and social justice perspective. And we have to talk about how the war on drugs and the way we dealt with the crack epidemic has been a precursor to why we cannot get our hands around the opioid crisis. And we cannot move through the opioid crisis until we look at everybody, regardless of their skin color, regardless of their class, and regardless of what neighborhood they live in, and deal with addiction as a clinical and compassionate issue and not just punitive. So as you can see, I'm passionate about these things. And we're going to move forward. We're going to move through this with the spirit of love and putting people before all other things. That's what we're going to do in this campaign.
How do you plan to address issues of race, Tahira? You know, the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years, have been extremely controversial here in the United States. And one of them is because we did have a Black president that, in my opinion, could have done much more on the issue of race. And he was being extremely diplomatic. I also think that the American government could have done more more to hold police, you know, excessive police brutality and excessive murders due to police, inappropriate police interventions. And we didn't. We failed on those issues. And some of that, I believe, are issues that are very prevalent here as well in our area. What do you plan? What is your plan to address some of those issues?
When I think about President Obama's presidency, and I the other day had an opportunity to watch his speech, what they call the race speech on the campaign trail, March 2008, or the More Perfect Union speech, which is really worth going back and watching it. And you're dead on. He was so diplomatic and so delicate in how he talked about it. I thought it was very effective for that time. But look at what's happened in 2017 alone. We've been forced to talk about race from the point of view that we have a white supremacy problem. So you can't go on social media, open a newspaper now without talking about Charlottesville and white supremacy. And I'm sitting here like popping popcorn, like, whoa, we're actually talking about this in open communication and dialogue and forcing our country to come to terms with something that used to be a conversation that we would whisper about, that we were afraid to talk about, that we would dance around. So I think right now it feels like we are in this process of talking about the issue and working towards healing issue. And that is that we have institutional constructs that favor sort of a bit of a racist structure. And until we talk about it, then we're not going to be able to resolve it. And I never, ever thought I'd see the day where I'd use the word white supremacy in public. So that's how we're going to talk about it in this campaign.
That really is a problem.
Yeah, it
white supremacy,
is.
Right?
White supremacy is a
you
problem.
You know, because color is not an issue, right? Race is not the issue. It's white supremacy. And I think that if we were to address the issue based on white supremacy and how that is a major problem in our society, then maybe we would get some headway. But my question more was, Tahira, around, and again, that's my style. I like to push, right? My question is more around accountability. What are we going to do to hold law enforcement accountable for the injustices that they've committed themselves?
Well, right now, with some of the walking back that the Trump administration has done on the progress that President Obama's administration made, particularly around police accountability and other programs that in the 11th hour of that presidency became a focal point, our campaign is going to continue to talk about it and make sure that we don't lose whatever progress that we made. And again, because of the natural occurrence of events in 2017 and into now, we have to continue to talk about accountability. We have to talk about hate crimes that are occurring. And we're not just talking about towards Black and brown people. We're talking about hate crimes that are occurring to members of the religious communities, plural, that we're just not talking about. We have a shooting up of a church and 3 months ago, and nobody's talking about that anymore. We're not talking about massacres of people who are being attacked in their houses of worship. So we do have to use the people power and energy to hold our federal and state governments accountable for the hate crimes that are occurring based on race, based on religion, based on class, all of the above, and propose responses to it. And I'm not shy about talking about it.
I just want to say that I never hung up on Kathy, who's still, I think, there on the line. So did we answer all your questions?
Pretty much. And I'd love to hear out what Jennifer feels about this.
Great.
Okay, thanks.
I can see you, Bob. I'll see you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a white woman, I want to speak about communities that have white privilege and how important these hard conversations and honest language is. I mean, it's time to say it. Trump is a racist. This is not new. He has a long history through his father's business of policies that were racist. His words in the campaign, his words now, and the policies that he puts forward. And, you know, it's so important when I think about, you know, yes, yesterday was, you know, the Women's March, but to talk about, you know, we need to really talk about intersectionality. And overall, what was the number, 55% of white females? Is that the number? I can't remember.
Yes.
Voted for Donald Trump. And so, you know, we need to think about who we are and the privileges we have and think about why that is happening. What I also, you know, related to that want to say is that it really was black women in Alabama who secured the victory for Doug Jones. And that was about organizing. That was about getting out the vote. And I don't like the language around, you know, when people say, well, black women saved us. And no, you know, they saved themselves. This was, you know, they saved their own communities. That's not their job. It's our job, you know. And I'm not saying, I don't want to say we're all divided into groups. I think we're all working together. But in other words, let's all step up into whatever communities that various communities we all participate in, you know, and do something. I'm very proud of my own local Jewish community and my rabbi, Justin David at CBI, who was one of the rabbis in New York who was arrested right after the first Muslim ban was put through. I'm also proud of my community. I'm part of attorneys. And I want to say Tahara is part of my attorney community as well, you know, in the broader community and what lawyers are doing to step up here. So every community in which you participate, there's a way to be active and resist this assault on human rights from the Trump administration. It's an assault on LGBTIA rights, women's rights, civil rights. I can make, you know, we can keep immigrants' rights, and an assault on the Constitution and rule of law. And we need to be honest about it, and, you know, in a complete disregard for ethics. So this is what we're facing. And, you know, having the hard conversations means speaking to those within our various communities who either feel like they can just put their head in the sand or want to maybe not confront their own racism. And I think that happens a lot. You know, you may have a racist family member, or you yourself don't want to really do the hard work and talk about how you've been conditioned by this culture. And until everybody faces that in their own communities, we're not going to really, you know, be confronting what the Trump administration is about, white supremacy and racism.
And one of the biggest needs is to get these Republicans out of office. And my understanding is that was one of the major goals of the Women's March, right? And the women's movement is to elect more individuals into office that kind of reflect and mirror these diverse individuals, different races, different backgrounds, and that mirror actually the issues that are important to us and represent those issues. Do you think that the Women's March and movement has had some success in doing that in the last year or so?
I do think so. If you look at a lot of the state level races throughout the country and throughout the year where we've had a number of transgender candidates step up, I think there are a lot of people, I think, you know, Tahara said at the beginning, where people said, wait, this level of incompetency can rise to the top. I think I had that moment for myself when Sarah Palin was back in 2008, the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party. I used to be a kind of a shy person. I am an academic and I work very hard to carefully craft the language I want to use, research all, you know, the facts, and only express things after much thought, because I don't want to make a mistake. You know, my view is don't make a mistake, don't say anything wrong, don't, you know, split an infinitive, whatever. Very, very hard on myself. And then I saw these people like Sarah Palin going out there with completely, you know, distasteful policies, but also incorrect, unchecked information. I said, well, what am I doing? That in a way, it's a kind of arrogance and perfectionism. And if I have the ability to participate and help, then I need to, you know, to step forward with people that are that incompetent. And I want to say one other thing, which is I want to work on Tahara's campaign.
That was my next question. I mean, what can we do to help Tahara?
I cannot vote for her because I don't work for her. But this is, you know, I think she's brilliant. I think her heart is in the right place. She's well organized. So I wonder how we can, even if we cannot vote for her, how we can help her win. Because, you know, 29 years of Richie Neal's getting on 30, you know, it's time to, I think, step aside. People want to say they want women to advance. I hear a lot of men say that, but they're not willing to give up, you know, and say, hey, I've had a good gig for 30 years. I mean, really, he should be backing her for office instead of running, as far as I'm concerned.
I love it.
imagine if all the women who came out to the Northampton March signed up to help you get into office.
Yeah.
I think that's what this is about, right? It's not only about showing up at marches. It's about doing the legwork, right? So how can people support you, Tahereh?
Thanks for asking. And I welcome your help with the campaign. It's just funny, as an aside, I'll say that I've gotten so much attention and so much love from communities outside of our district. Amherst, Northampton, and Greenfield. I call them friends, using the Pod Save America logo. Friends of the district. Those are my friends of the district. So we have a website that's wonderful and beautifully maintained by our team. It's TahereahForCongress.com. So it's TAHIRAH for Congress.com. We also have a Facebook page, same thing. And we're across all social media platforms with that handle, except on Twitter and Snapchat, it's Tahereah Congress. And so we are really responsive. You can send an email, you can send a post, and we're there. I'm also personally on all social media platforms as my first name, last two initials. So TAHIRAHAW.
And you have campaign managers already and your whole campaign team and... You know, in place.
Well,
and
we're organizing it all. So we have volunteers that we're putting into place. We're putting our strategists into place, our campaign manager. So we're still forming it. I'm going to hold a volunteers retreat soon, maybe within 2 weeks. And we're going to have pizza and just map it all out. Who's taking what roles? We're going to keep going. But yeah, it's been wonderful. The response has been overwhelming. One of the things about running as a woman, running as an African American woman running on a progressive platform, is of course that means that we need funding, we need money, we need campaign contributions to fuel this. We're going to have expenses, and we do have expenses. In order to deliver the things that our community needs, we have to make an investment. So I'd ask people to also consider investing in the campaign, which you can find out about in all of the ways I just described above.
Can you highlight any ways that you think Richard Neal is failing the public?
Well, when I talk to people, and I, you know, in my role as a lawyer and in my role as a public speaker, which is what I've done also a lot in the last couple of years, I get to speak to community groups, interfaith groups, college students. What I hear them expressing is that they feel that they do not know if their representative in the federal seat hears them and reflects their values and what it is that they want. Sometimes what people need in a champion is compassion and attention, regardless of what is actually happening. If your people, if your clients, because I'm a lawyer, if your clients don't feel like you hear them and understand and love them, then you are inefficient and ineffective at being their representative. And so that's one of the reasons that I make sure that I take the time out for everyone across the district and look at it like we're one family, we're one community, we're one neighborhood. At least the federal government sees us as one 3,000 square mile neighborhood. And that we're strength. There's a strength in that level of diversity, demographic and geographic and et cetera.
I have a couple questions, quick questions, because, you know, we're running out of time and I'm like, oh my God, this is so good, right? So the first question is, why are you running, I think? You know, like, what made you decide to run? And two, if you were to get into office, what is the first thing that you're going to do?
Why am I running? Because we cannot afford to delay me running. At this point, our community is probably as desperate as it's been, and we realize it. We realize that we're not making the level of progress that we should be making, having a 29-year incumbent in that seat. In my opinion, when you get to a point where you sit on these different committees and you've been in that role for almost 3 decades, your district should be one of the most on-point districts in the country. And until we can say that, we have not won. So why me? Why now? I know the people. I've been advocating for this community since I was 17 years old. I love the community. I have 7 children, parents, a husband. And I feel that if I don't now, when will we? Because otherwise, we'll be sitting here in another 30 years having this same conversation about why we don't have more diversity, why women aren't leading here in the first congressional district. And what is the first thing I'll do when we win?
I already have this vision. Good. I already have this vision. And my team keeps trying to talk me down. They're saying, calm down. I want to dedicate, and I will in some capacity, but they're trying to talk me down from just going all out and saying it. I want to dedicate our first year in office to the children. I want to dedicate the first year in office to the children, where we look at every single policy advanced and draft policies, and we always have some lens into its immediate impact on the children of the 1st Congressional District and its future impact. So you see, that means everybody. See how that works? Everybody. No matter what policy that we're talking about, we look at it and we think about how does this impact the kids now and how will it impact their future. I want to make sure we have vibrant internships for our students to come in from Massachusetts and come to D.C. and have exchange student type housing so that kids don't have to worry about whether they can afford an internship like that. We make it possible and throughout the district. So you can see I'm very excited about it, and that will be one of the first priorities that I have. The policy stuff that I've talked about, making sure I learn my way around, we're going to do that. But the kids are coming with me. That's the first year in office.
That's a great issue. I don't know if you're aware, Tahira, but I work in with youth and families during the day. Now, my question is for Jennifer. If I was to nominate you to be the campaign manager, one of Tahira's campaign managers, what advice would you give Tahira as far as strategy?
Well, the first thing I would do is say, keep doing what you're doing. Mm. She's got incredible energy. She knows the policy issues, and she knows her community. So those things together bring a lot of inspiration. And I would, you know, I'm not someone who, my management style is to ask people first, what do you think your strengths are, and where, you know, where do you think the gaps are as the first step. So, you know, but what I would say is, you know, the issues she's tapped into, the economic issues, are real issues. The opioid crisis are real issues. And she's been very diplomatic, so I wouldn't tell her to do it. But someone on her team has got to actually look at Richard Neal's record and say, where has he been? Now, of course, you could be in Congress for a lifetime, look at someone like Ted Kennedy, and refresh yourself constantly. But the question is, is he every 2 years when he gets sworn in, is he recommitting himself and saying, here's the new challenge in front of us. Mm. Here's what people in my community say we need. Mm. I don't see him leading. And maybe he just, you know, doesn't get out there in front of the media, but I don't see him being leading in the same way. I live in Northampton and I have Jim McGovern, and I see his voice out there. Mm-hmm. I see him leading issues. Also, you know, I see Senator Elizabeth Warren. I see from Massachusetts. I see folks like, you know, Sherrod Brown from Ohio. You know, I don't want to make a whole long list of progressive leaders. I mean, I could, but there are folks who get out there and, you know, lead, talk about the vision, listen to the community. And that's not something that, you know, I've seen Richard Neal do. Now, maybe, he, you know, he or his team will hear this radio station and decide they need to step up. But it shouldn't take someone running against you who's incredibly brilliant, committed, and talented to wake you up. I mean this with love. You know, there are times, 30 years, you know, I haven't done anything for 30 years. Sometimes it's time to really move on and, you know, take, you know, and lend your support. And it would be, you know, to me, and I'm not joking, I think it'd be kind of a beautiful thing if he threw his support behind this brilliant woman with a, you know, a voice for the future and say, you know, it's time. It's time for me to pass the torch. You know, that's what I see. So, again, I think she's doing everything right, but I think someone on her campaign needs to get tough, not in her voice, but someone else needs to actually look at her competition.
All right. So just to let you know, we have about maybe 5 or so minutes left, maybe 5 to 8 minutes left of the show. And I'd like to give each one of you an opportunity to kind of wrap up. And, you know, if there's anything that you want to tell.
Before we do the wrap up, can I ask a question? I'm thinking from the angle of the Occupy movement, because this show came out of mm-hmm. Occupy. So mm-hmm. This almost immediately after Occupy Wall Street started occupying Zuccotti Park in New York, we started this show here and was a back and forth, and we were part of that movement. So in terms of channeling some of that, one, it was a popular democracy, so which sometimes electoral politics is the furthest thing from that. The other thing is that Occupy Wall Street was really a rebellion against basically we had a national government led by the Democrats who were not, you know, there was a recovery, but it was a recovery of the giants. It was a recovery of Wall Street, a recovery of the real estate industry, a recovery of GM. And there wasn't a recovery for the people. And so it seems like part of, you know, and this is like stretching it out in a whole other direction in some ways, but there was a failure in this election to pull working people into the Democratic fold, a traditional kind of strongholds like Wisconsin, you know, an amazing union state, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and losing the working class there. And so, so where is the question out of this? The new progressive parties, how do you address that? Because I see losing Pennsylvania is not a failure, not because they're racist per se, although you have to sort of hold your nose and vote for Donald Trump. It has elements of racism to it, but people were desperate. So I don't know if you can have a response to that without a clear question.
Yeah. Can I just this is Jennifer, and you know, I spent a number of years after the financial crisis working on those policy issues and writing a book, and it was called Other People's Houses, and looked at the mortgage crisis pretty closely. And
no, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Oh. And what I want to say is that I think Trump very cleverly, in the way that he is a charlatan, picked up on the themes that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren brought up in terms of the problems with the Wall Street bailout. And he made all kinds of promises the same way he made promises when he ran Trump University, and they weren't true. He claimed that he was going to break up the banks. He said he was opposed to, you know, Wall Street and Goldman Sachs. And then you see what he's actually done. He appointed, as we know, to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mulvaney, and they've already started to roll back many of the important protections the Consumer Bureau put through. Just recently, there was a new rule on payday lending, and they're going to not enforce that. There's so much of Dodd-Frank, and it was a mild statute that they're just rolling back. So I think part of the problem in failing to really address those issues helped bring in this charlatan who made false promises to the public.
Do you have a response to sort of my long, vague comments and questions in terms of, like, what Occupy was exposing? Also, even Black Lives Matter, that there was this failure in the country, and they were grassroots movements. They weren't electoral. Neither movement really had an electoral front at all. But now we're trying to address some of that stuff. But how do we meet, what happened with those failures? Why haven't the progressives on the electoral front really been able to make strides in those directions?
From what I can tell, the Democratic Party hasn't done the work that it's needed to do over the past 30 years. It hasn't been strong. It hasn't been inclusive. It hasn't had a succession plan. And we now realize that. Again, I'm 44, so I can't take responsibility for what's happened over the past 30 years. The best thing that I can do is figure out how to get in now and how to unite with other people who have the shared values. Labels aside, I mean, labels are important, but labels can also be constricting, move forward under this particular banner. And a number of people come and tell me that they're independent or with the Green Party, but if we share common values, then I'm happy to work with you. And that's basically where I see things going. But you're right, there's a deep history, and it's not always pretty, and it's dysfunctional at times and what have you, and we're just kind of picking up the mess and running with it.
That sounds absolutely great. Last parting words, maybe a minute apiece.
I guess my last parting words are, you know, we have a gem here, Tara for Congress for the 1st District.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's absolutely great.
Thank you. And I'm really excited and grateful to be here. And again, grateful again to be a part of the Women's March yesterday. And I just want to uplift the organizers, Lindsay, Alicia, and Rachel, for coming together and making sure that we had a really kick butt program, and that there was great representation amongst the performers and the speakers. And I'm grateful again to have been a part of it, and grateful to be here today with my new friends.
That is absolutely great. I know that I'm going to be looking into your campaign more so and trying to keep up to date with that. And I really wish you well as one woman of color another who has also run for office herself. Mm-hmm. And so I do understand a lot of the challenges when you're going up against a political machine, right?
Yes.
You know, in the making of for 30 years. I think that your description of this is Herculean, but I do admire you so much for doing that. I know that I ran against a political machine in Holyoke, and I was really proud of the fact that I made those gears run and turn up, right? So I'm hoping that you're gonna. I'm hoping that you're gonna have lots of success. And if anything, at least you're challenging the status quo, and you're making people. You're pushing. Politics to the left, and you're holding people accountable for their positions, right? I really appreciate you coming on board. Any last words, Bob?
No, but except that people have been listening to Occupy the Airwaves on Valley Free Radio, WXLJLP 103.3 FM. Thanks for listening. We look forward to having you back next week, and you're always free to call. So
thank you so much.
Thanks, Kathy, for calling.
Thank you so much, and enjoy your week.
Good job.
Mm-hmm. Fight the power.
Thank you.
We go occupy. We the 99. With the people, don't let these cowards deceive you and be the next mouse in the talons of an eagle. This country's wealth gap is an unbalanced as evil. We celebrate access while the people have less in poverty, abject madness. While the economy collapses, add stress, that's the last straw. You want class war, we'll give you what you ask for. The have nots at the haves, though we came to crash your party and we ain't leaving until we even. The Constitution guarantees these freedoms. Anyone against that committing treason, you're not a real patriot unless you stand for what you believe in. And nobody got more welfare than Wall Street. Hundreds of billions after operating falsely. And nobody went to prison, that's where you lost me. But my home, my job, and my life is what it cost me. We are 99. We go occupy. We are 99. We go occupy. We are 99. We go occupy. Occupy. Remember when police beat Egyptians who were defiant? Even President Obama condemned the violence. But when NYPD beat America, there's silence. It's apparent that there's bias. Sticks for the people, but give carrots to the liars. Those crooked cops just for embarrassment should be fired. And if you want to see terrorists, then look higher. They in the skyscrapers with billions from my labor. Forcing people out of their homes with falsified data. So it's either unify now or cry later. 1% got the wealth, but the 99's greater. So in every city, we gon' occupy major. Cause nobody got more welfare than Wall Street. Hundreds of billions after operating falsely. And nobody went to prison. That's what you lost me, but my home, my job, and my life is what it cost me. We are 99. We go occupy. We are 99. We go occupy. Check the banker's credit score.
that's only there for you and me, so they can gouge us even more. Yeah, they love their zero interest policy. You see, with Uncle Ben and his printing press, Turbo Tim and his bailout chest, they pour it out, but it don't get to you. And every new solution is just more debt, one less strand in the safety net. Too big to fail, took that away from you. Ever wonder where that money went? It's not in the economy or anywhere that you can spend. No, those bankers, they just speculate. The money's in the price of gas, the price of food there on your plate. Yeah, they love their zero interest policy. You see, with Uncle Ben and his printing press, Turbo Tim and his bailout chest, they pour it out, but it don't get to you. And every new solution is just more debt, one less strand in the safety net. Too big to fail, took that away from you. To you, it don't get to you.